Hello, listeners, and welcome to a very special bonus episode of The Europeans. We are going to be playing you a longer version of the interview you may have heard in our most recent episode. We really enjoyed speaking to Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who is one of the leading contemporary voices on Islam, according to the BBC. And he's just written this book about Islam in Europe. And yeah, we thought it was really interesting. So we thought it was worth playing a bit more of the interview, even though, total transparency, I did leave before the end of the interview.
Don't tell everyone that.
I shouldn't tell everyone.
We could totally have got away with no one ever knowing.
Well, Katie, let's just be honest about it. People will be like, why is Dominic really quiet?
It's because Katie just won't stop talking, as usual.
It's because I left, because I had to go to the theatre to work. Some of us have to bring the bacon home.
I bring home the bacon. I'm literally late for work right now because we're recording this, so we better get on with it.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, sorry.
As mentioned, you'll probably have heard part of this conversation already, but there was just so much that we talked about that we didn't have time to put in last week's episode, so we thought we'd give you the whole thing. In particular, we talk quite a lot more about the history of Islam's role in Europe and go into a bit more depth as well about the kind of challenges that it faces in terms of working out what its role is in the continent today. And Akbar in general is just a super knowledgeable and thoughtful person.
He's also just an incredibly nice man.
Excellent. Good, Katie, we are on.
Excellent. Ambassador, it's a real pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all, not at all.
Hi, and I'm Dominic here. I'm with Katie as well.
Hi, Dominic. Oh. You're in Munich?
I am indeed, yes.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Munich features very heavily in my book and film.
Yeah, I saw that. In what way does Munich feature? I was interested because I saw that it was...
Two kinds of ways, positive, negative. It's a presence, has a great city, is great cultural center.
Have they got a quite big Muslim community then in Munich?
Yes, there is. There is a great community. But you know, I found it fascinating that the honorary Pakistani Consul General that's appointed by the ambassador in Berlin is a German and he's based in Munich. So he was kind enough to invite us, me and my team, to his house for dinner. And I saw the German flag and the Pakistani flag hanging out from his balcony, and he was very proud of the Pakistani flag, and he made some interesting comments on Germans and Pakistanis, which again are in the book.
Excellent. I look forward to reading about that. I guess my first question is this. We live in a continent where we have seen repeated terrorist attacks in the name of Islam. We have seen Muslim immigrants demonized in repeated election campaigns. And we've seen Islamophobia become a daily problem for ordinary Muslims across Europe. You've written in your book that we stand at a crossroads in terms of Islam's place in Europe. Could you start by telling us what you mean by that?
By that, I mean that we are at a point in history where we are literally at the crossroads in terms of Europe. On the one hand, you have all these terrible incidents. They're feeding into the far-right politics, far-right movements. And into far-right, very dangerous-sounding rhetoric, which echoes very often the 1930s and 40s. On the other hand, I met some very inspiring people on this journey throughout Europe. Remember, I went to East, West, North, and South. And those sages of Europe, those wonderful, wise men and women of Europe, really, really inspired me and gave me a lot of hope. So I don't want to dismiss that hope and that optimism. It exists. The problem is, I don't think Europe is listening to those voices. Europe is listening to the strident voices. Europe is absorbing the media images, which, as you say, point to all the violence and the terrorism which has happened, which is happening. And I'm afraid unless things are controlled, it will continue to happen. The answers to that violence, the answers to that movement towards that direction, lie really in listening to the sages of Europe and those wise voices.
Presumably you found similar results when you did an in-depth study into America as well. But I was just interested to find out what the main differences were in terms of like the what needs to be done.
Dominic, that's a great question. There are many things that are similar. Societies, in some senses, have similar problems and similar solutions. But in some senses, they are fundamentally different. Remember, the Muslim community in America and the Muslim community in Europe come from different sources. They're different sociologically, culturally, politically. For example, the Muslims coming to America come largely in the 1960s and onwards. And they're coming in as middle class, very often as doctors, medical doctors, entrepreneurs, and quite comfortably fitting into a middle class pattern and very quickly realizing what is called the American dream. That's not happening in Europe because it takes two or three generations before the immigrants in Europe begin to make an impact, if they're making an impact. So in England, you have a mayor, in Rotterdam, you have a mayor who's a Muslim. You have a dozen members of the House of Lords in London, House of Commons. You have TV presenters and so on and so on. And you've got these great footballers who are iconic in the cultural context. But as a community, the community is still struggling because their expectations have changed over the generations that they've been here. And they came really as guest workers. They were invited here to man the factories, the buses in Britain, for example. In Germany, they came under contract as guest workers. So very different cultural backgrounds. And most of them were coming from working class backgrounds. They knew little English even, or French or whatever. And they were coming simply as a survival strategy, escaping poverty, perhaps wanting to bring their kids across and give them a better education and a better life. And they find that three generations later, when their children are being born here and growing up here, that they're not quite fully accepted. They may have a passport. They may be completely as educated in that culture as their European-blooded colleague or class fellow, but they're not fully accepted. And the result is that they are now finding themselves neither fully accepted back home. So many Turks told me when we go back to Turkey, people say, you're Germans, you're not Turks. And when we come back here, the Germans say, well, you speak German, you look German, you've absorbed German culture, but you're not really German. And that is their dilemma. They're sort of suspended between cultures.
Of course, within Europe, we have lots of different national communities that count Muslims amongst them. Turks, Bosnians, second or third generation, British Pakistanis, French Algerians, Chechens, Syrian refugees, Afghan refugees, so many different communities. For what extent did you find it useful on your travels to think of Europe's Muslims as a single community?
Katie, on two levels, and this is a good question because I tackled this project really as a scientific anthropologist. So it wasn't like me saying, this is what I would like, or this is what's happening, or I'm romanticizing it. I really let the statistics, the interviews, the facts and figures speak for themselves. So in terms of these categories, it is useful to talk of Europe, but Europe is not one monolithic country or culture. And similarly, the Muslims are not. For example, the North Africans coming to France are different in many ways to the South Asians coming to Britain, to the Turks coming to Germany. And they have very different backgrounds. The Turks coming to Germany were never colonized by Europe. They, in fact, were colonists themselves. They have many memories of being the Ottomans, the descendants of the Ottomans, who at one stage conquered and ruled parts of East Europe. So very different backgrounds. Africans, again, different relationship to France. So yes, they are not a monolith. Today, after 9/11 especially, they are seen as a monolith by the media. So the media will simply say, a Muslim did this, a Muslim terrorist did this, whether he's Algerian or Moroccan or Pakistani or whatever. But they are not similar. They're coming from different backgrounds. And I've analyzed the individual terrorists from all of these incidents and traced the ethnic lineage of these terrorists, which is not normally done because security experts tend to look again at all terrorists as Muslims and as a monolith. And when you begin to look at them through the lens of ethnicity, which I do as an anthropologist, you'll discover that these tribal links give us a lot of clues to their real thinking, because tribal links then point to tribal codes, codes of honor, codes of revenge, codes of behavior, which will help us to deal with the situation in the future, where we can then speak to them through this particular code.
And I believe you came up with kind of three broad categories of Islam within Europe in your book. I was wondering if you could give us a brief summary of these and like the battle between these different strands to dominate in the continent.
Yes. Now, these are, again, very broad categories. They tend to overlap, but broadly, you can identify Muslims on the basis of their political thinking, their political behavior, their social organization, as broadly mystic Islam, Sufis, people who believe in the universal humanism that most mystics share. And you'll find them. We went to many mystic gatherings. We are very privileged right across Europe, Ireland and Bosnia and so on in England. Then the literalists, the second category, they believe that we must adhere and believe in exactly what was practiced by the Holy Prophet of Islam in the 7th century. So there you have a model of behavior for Muslims. And those Muslims would reject Muslims who don't have a beard or who appear to be too westernized. And I'm not talking about westernized Muslims who reject Islam and say, no, we're going to violate all the rules of Islam. We are now secular. But I'm talking about even ordinary liberal Muslims. The literalists would say, as long as you stick exactly to what the Prophet did and said, it's fine. If you don't, you're not a Muslim. We don't accept it. That creates all kinds of problems, as you can imagine. And they very often target, and sometimes this becomes violent, those Muslims that they see as not being living up to Islam. And then, of course, you have the third category, which are the modernists, the modernist Muslims who would like to balance tradition from the past, which includes faith, and modernity. So how do you balance the past and the present? And in a sense, this struggle which we are seeing is really a struggle within these three categories. And I thought, as having grown up in this modernist category with a very strong leaning towards mysticism, I thought that in a couple of decades after independence, when most Muslim countries got independence, in the middle of the 20th century, that modernist Islam would prevail. There was talk of democracy and accountability and joining the World Committee of Nations. But now we are seeing, in fact, a strong and a very violent conflict taking place right across the Muslim world with the symptoms of the literalists emerging and a perverted form of literalism. We should be very careful because not every literalist would want violence or even suggest violence, but invariably leads to it when you're that rigid about your interpretation of faith.
This is perhaps an oversimplified question, but did you find on your travels around Europe countries that were doing it right, in your view, or countries that were doing it better than others in terms of community relations?
You know, I found that countries are very serious about tackling this problem. Europe is waking up. Many countries, the Germans, for example, they are waking up. Here is a problem. And in some very characteristic ways, each country is responding in the way it responds. The Germans, for example, who always respond with method, with determination, and very impressively, they're saying, all right, let's study the problem, then let's tackle it. And I found that they were opening up these chairs of Islamic studies, Islamic centers, very impressive, and beginning to say, all right, how do we tackle this problem? But at the same time, the question of getting it right becomes vital. And that is where I think a study like ours does help, because we talk to a whole range of people. So in Germany, for example, we talk to the immigration officer dealing with immigrants. We talk to throughout Europe to chief rabbis and grand muftis and Archbishop of Canterbury and people on the right, some very hardcore right-wing people. So we got their perspective on Muslims and immigrants and so on. So that way we were able to give concrete examples of how to deal with this problem. My last chapter, in fact, has some very solid recommendations. So yes, countries are, by and large, wanting to tackle this. Some, I'm afraid, towards the East, have sort of given up on this, and they really feel that we are taking the other road. And I'm not sure where that road is going to lead them, but I think that's a dangerous path. There's demonization of the minorities. There's widespread Islamophobia, widespread anti-Semitism. Because when you have Islamophobia, very quickly it morphs into anti-Semitism. And then there's all sorts of persecution of the Roma and other minorities. So it's not a very simple or very happy picture as it exists today.
Can you just give us a few examples maybe of those recommendations that you mentioned in your final chapter?
My first recommendation was for Europe to listen to its sages. My second one is to discover its own past or rediscover its past. For example, I give the time of Andalusia when Muslims and Jews and Christians for long periods, not all the time, but for long periods, were able to live together, create together and live in a flourishing society. Cordoba at one stage had 93 libraries, and one of them, the main library, had 600,000 volumes. Wow. When the largest library in the rest of Europe had 600 books. So there was a great sense of culture and gardens and paths and cultures being able to flourish together. And that was not just a Muslim thing. You go to the East and you'll see Sicily, Italy, and the Emperor Frederick II, the remarkable emperor, one of the heroes of Europe. And I found people today have no idea who Frederick was, or Roger II, or Alfonso X of Spain. These are Christian kings, mainstream Orthodox Christian kings, yet very inclusive, creating cultures which you could feel proud of today. Why aren't we able to resuscitate them or talk of them as examples? Obviously, you can't recreate history. We don't want that. If you want a kind of new Andalusia, you need to know about it. The spirit of that, I think, would be able to inspire Europe. The problem is that most of North Europe, that's the Northern Europe, there's also this North-South division, very distinctly divided. North Europe does not take South Europe as seriously as it should, and it has a lot to learn from South Europe. And one of the things it has to learn are figures like Frederick II, who was German but also lived in Sicily and Italy. That was the basis of his kingdom. Alfonso, of course, was in Spain. And they have a lot to teach us in terms of the alternative to this path which leads to confrontation and racist and religious violence.
I wanted to ask quickly about the kind of hangover of colonialism in Europe and how that affects the Muslim communities living in Europe, and specifically like how the different colonial setups, perhaps like in France from Algeria, how that affects how Muslim communities are living in Europe in present day.
It affects it greatly. And here's the core difference between Britain, France, partly Germany, Europe broadly, and America, where there is no hangover from any colonial era, because the Americans did not really colonize Muslim countries. They were in the Philippines, there were Muslims there, but not like colonizing India or Egypt or North Africa, many of the Muslim countries. So there is a great difference. But I want you to step back and look at this slightly differently. Look at it in a philosophic sense. If Aristotle asked what was the purpose of life, then for me, this study was really raising the question, the big philosophic question, how do minority and majority societies live together in this age? How do you deal with the other in terms of religion or culture? And that was the big question, you see. So when you ask that question, then Dominique, your question about the colonial era impacting us today immediately falls into place. So it's not a question of a former colonial from Algeria settling in France and having a problem. It's how the majority deals with the minority there.
Yeah.
And that is the core problem of Europe today. That is the challenge Europe faces, because at the heart of it, you have the question of modernity. Does Europe take the road of genuine modernity, which includes the idea of individual citizenship, that everyone is equal before the law? And you cannot all say you're all equal before the law when you treat a minority community in the way it is being treated in much of Europe today. There are many, many parts where Muslims are either attacked, or their women are attacked, or their mosques are attacked. And that morphs, as I said, into anti-Semitism, which is happening fairly frequently in France, for example. And tragically, Muslims are joining that anti-Semitic wave, as it were, in attacking Jews. These patterns that are emerging in society have to be challenged. They have to be checked, and we have to come up with solutions. Therefore, I go back to my earlier point, read your own history in Europe, rediscover your history, the inspiring parts, listen to the sages. And as I said, this is not just the list of recommendations. I've just given you two or three suggestions, but there are many, many suggestions. And this can be tackled. It has been tackled in the past, and it needs to be tackled, because ultimately Europe is a symbol of something. It is a symbol of modernity itself. It's a symbol of Greece and ancient civilization and the basis of much of the modern world. And if Europe falls in that sense, it'll affect not only just this continent, it'll affect and infect so many other continents all around it that it has so greatly influenced. I mean, I grew up very much influenced by Europe. I was educated by Europeans. I'm very grateful for that. I speak a European language. We're speaking English. And we have to treasure that and not lose it.
I live in France. I'm a reporter in France. So I'm particularly interested in what you made of the role of Islam in France. You know, it comes up all the time in my job as a reporter, especially because in France, secularism is really, really important in public life. But the way that that manifests itself to me often looks like Islamophobia. It's a very sort of specific French logic that they have around it. I'll give you an example. The head of the National Student Union, she's a young Muslim woman. She wore her hijab in a recent TV interview, and the interior minister was quickly up there accusing her of setting a bad example by trying to spread her religion on TV, and it became this big thing.
Yeah, I followed that, Kitty. I followed that. And as you know, I have a lengthy discussion on all this, and I go into France in some detail. France is fascinating because, you know, I grew up in South Asia. So for me, I look at England as a kind of standard European country, but each country is very different, and each European imperialist country is very different, and France is very different to Britain even. So there are differences. Now, in France, since you're there, you need to remember when you're reporting all this, that this was not always the case. This Islamophobia was not always inherent to how the French looked at the Muslim world. And for that, go back to Napoleon Bonaparte, the unlikely example, who lands up in Cairo. He gives a dinner for the sheikhs of Al-Azhar. Now, picture this, Ketty. He wears Arab robes. He invites the sheikhs of Al-Azhar. And he gives a speech in which he says the holy book, the Quran, is the greatest book of inspiration. And the holy prophet is the example for which we should all follow. And the people of Egypt begin to call him Sheikh Ali. Ali, of course, is the cousin of the Prophet of Islam and his son-in-law. So you can see Egyptians saying, this man is so close to us, we would love to be his followers. And a lot of them began to say he's a better alternative to the Ottomans, who were seen as tyrants. So that was the attitude. Now, history takes a turn, because had Napoleon not been defeated by Nelson, he was planning to reach out to Tipu Sultan in India, who was fighting the British. And had Napoleon succeeded in India, the history of the world would have been very different. But that did not happen. Napoleon came back, you know, Waterloo, everything finished. And that was the first exploration of the Muslim world, and it collapses there. The next time the French come and encounter the Muslims in the 1830s and 40s, it's very different. This time around, they land in Algeria, and it's a straightforward military expedition. Burn, kill, slaughter. And read the history there, and it's frightening, because that sets the tone. The concept is that Algeria is an extension of France, is part of French civilization. And these guys really shouldn't be here. It's frankly, it's as crude as that. And some terrible figures emerge. And just check them. People were shocked when they read this. Several, in fact, French readers of the book wrote and said, well, these figures couldn't be correct. And I said, just check them again. And I didn't hear from them again. But large numbers, these really scary numbers, were simply wiped out. I mean, I'm talking something like 2/3 of the entire population in very brutal ways, because the philosophy was different. The philosophy was, this is part of France. It's an extension. Now, when independence comes, again, have a look at it. How does it come? It comes with a great deal of bloodshed. It wasn't given gracefully or easily. We are now, again, talking of millions in populations in Algeria, with tiny populations. It's very tiny tribal population. So when independence is achieved and now the Algerians want to migrate to France as immigrants, you immediately have problems, because they're coming with bad memories. The French don't have good memories of Muslims in Africa, because they've been resisting, there's fighting, there's all kinds of stories of torture and terrible violent deeds on both sides and so on. And when you have economic crises, as you have now, all kinds of unemployment, and the pressure immediately descends on the immigrants. And then these little symbols, because the hijab and the niqab and all, we all know these are very tiny symbols. How many women wear the niqab in France? We know it's not even more than a couple of hundred. But they become huge symbols, and they become symbols of a battle. And I've given examples of all the great, the high and the mighty of France lining up against these couple of hundred women who want to wear what they want to wear. In France, it's become such a huge symbol that it's become something worth fighting for. So you'll have all this lineup that you mentioned. And if this young girl appears on TV with it, she suddenly becomes a threat to the Republic. And I really think that the French in this regard have to chill out and see it on a different level and on a different scale. They have to be much more philosophic about it and say, how are we treating our own minority? Because these Muslims are French. They're living here. They're not going to go back to Algeria or wherever they come from in Africa. And therefore, how do we best integrate them or incorporate them or make them feel French? That is the philosophy with which to implement the policy towards the immigrants if there's hope of integrating them over the next generation or two. This is what I found on our travels.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I just had one final question for you, Ambassador. It seems like increasingly around Europe, we have politicians like Angela Merkel or Viktor Orban, who've been kind of lining up to stress Europe's Christian tradition, saying, you know, this is a continent built on Christian values. And for me, there's often a kind of hidden subtext in there. They're basically saying, read between the lines, they're saying Christian as opposed to Muslim. And I'm curious to hear what you think about the fact that politicians are saying that increasingly. What should we make of it?
Katie, that's a great question. And I hope that these politicians who are saying that Europe is a Christian continent will listen to my answer. They don't know their own history. Charlemagne, one of the greatest founding kings, emperors of Europe, he is projected as a Christian ruler fighting the Muslims in Andalusia. But what people don't tell you is that he had the warmest relations with the greatest Muslim ruler of his time, who was the Caliph Harun al-Rashid, who ruled from Baghdad and who ruled a mighty empire which stretched across the Middle East, across North Africa, and into Central Asia. Very good relations, and they exchanged gifts and so on. They will not tell you, or perhaps they don't know, that when the Ottomans came to besiege the city of Vienna for the second time, that there were thousands of Christian soldiers fighting for the Ottomans. And on the other side, supporting the local Europeans against the Ottomans were the Polish cavalry. And in the Polish cavalry, the best troops, the crack troops, were guess who? They were Muslims, the Muslim Tatars. And for that, they've been honored throughout Polish history. And in fact, the church has declared an Islam Day in Poland on account of the respect that the Tatar cavalry had and their role in history. So these are incidents in history which again and again tell us that this notion of Islam versus Christianity comes on and off and is used either by the church or by politicians or kings really to promote their own immediate political gains. And it's not part of society. I've given you examples in Andalusia. Of course, there's so many examples of the Caliph of Cordoba, who would employ Christians as ambassadors. The Caliph of Cordoba, Abdurrahman III, had a chief minister who was Jewish. His ambassador to the courts of Europe was a bishop. So the notion that these are all divided by religious lines is something that we are imposing on the past. It was there, but it wasn't as sharp and as absolute as is being promoted by these people. And if they are still promoting this idea, the simple fact is that there are millions of Muslims and they're not going anywhere. The only alternative is, if their logic is correct, is to deport them all or put them all into concentration camps or to just throw them into the sea. And if they're not going to do that, then they are stuck with them and they have to deal with them. It's as simple as that.
So that was Akbar Ahmed. His book, Journey into Europe, is out now, and you can find him on Twitter at AskAkbar, AKBAR. You can also find us on Twitter. We're there at EuropeansPod, and we're on Facebook, and we're on Instagram. So if you happen to miss us before we come back next Tuesday, you can find us there.
Or send us an email. We always love receiving emails, even if actually lately we haven't been very quick at responding. We need to get better at responding quickly, Katie.
Yeah, sorry everyone, we've been rubbish.
Anyway, yeah, send us an email to test how quickly we can respond.
Oh, nice.
Our email address is europeanspodcast@gmail.com.
See you on Tuesday, everyone. Bye.
Bye.